Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, where was a mikveh found on the island of Ortigia in Syracuse, Sicily? Dr. Judith R. Cohen has visited us here on English Corner many times before, so for those of you who follow our program, she probably needs no introduction. She's a Canadian ethnomusicologist specializing in Judeo-Spanish Sephardic music and its relationship with other traditions such as Balkan, Yiddish, and medieval Iberian music and pan-European balladry. In her seminars and performances, Judith sings songs from all of these sources and also accompanies herself on traditional string, wind, and percussion instruments. Although much of her work has been focused on the Iberian Peninsula, notably Portugal, this week she's speaking with us about a new project of hers in which she's researching emerging Jewish communities in Sicily. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Judith. Tell us about this new project and what you're doing.
Hi, Linda. As you know, I'm an ethnomusicologist by training, and I've been working for many years, close to a quarter of a century now, with the Portuguese Jews, and looking at the role of music in their lives and what we ethnomusicologists do, the role of music in building community, maintaining community. And I had heard about these new emerging communities, Jewish communities in Sicily and Calabria. And I was fascinated. And then a conference came up, the International Ballad Conference. And so I asked for a small research grant and decided I would do a pilot project extending my work in Portugal to these emerging communities. Because as you know, Sicily and parts of Calabria were under the Corona de Aragon, the Crown of Aragon, for centuries, and so the Inquisition touched them as well. And so whereas in the north of Italy, you just have Jewish communities, here in the south, they couldn't have Jewish communities for a long time. And now, just as in Portugal and parts of Spain, people are coming out and saying, well, I'm pretty sure that my family has Jewish origins, or my great-grandmother used to say or used to do this. And they're not communities in the sense of an organized community. And they don't even, one of them does have regular services, but almost no one goes. So basically there are three. And the first one is in Palermo, where I was for this conference. The second one is in Siracusa, which is just a couple of hours away. And the third one is outside Sicily, it's in Calabria, and it's a pretty different story.
So are these what you would call Marranos? Are these crypto-Jews who are still practicing Judaism or Jewish practices, either knowingly or unknowingly?
If anything, they were, I think, unknowingly. It was more, I mean, I didn't do extensive field work. I haven't done extensive field work yet, but what I've heard is more on the lines of, my grandmother used to say, used to do, and I'm pretty sure this indicates, or we have a tradition, or, you know, it's any number of things. But in terms of actual practices, the way you find among the Jews in Belmonte, for example, I don't think there's anything that specific. But also, a lot of the people I met are younger. You know, they're not in their 80s and 90s. They're in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. They're university educated. They're pretty sophisticated, cosmopolitan. Some of them have lived in England. And some of them have done their own research. You know, they've looked into it on their own, and some are less educated and more what we think of as, you know, village-like. So there's a very interesting range of people.
So are these people who are really interested in researching their family history, or are they interested in Judaism?
Some of both. So the situation in Palermo is there's a woman who's been instrumental in all this lately, and she's actually from Algeria. Her family are Algerian Sephardic Jews, and she was brought up in France in a fairly pretty observant home. But she fell in love, as she told me, she fell in love with a Catholic from Palermo, from Sicily. And she moved there and brought their children up, not even as Jews. And she stayed close to her parents, but stopped really living a very Jewish life. And then she decided that she really wanted to go back to that. And Well, it's a very long story, but to make the long story very short, she talked to a local archbishop who possibly has Converso roots himself, and he found an unused chapel of a former church that they believe was built over the ruins of a medieval synagogue. It's not totally documented, but this is what they think. But in any case, he seated, I'm saying the community, it's not really a community formally, but he seated what will be the community use of this chapel as a synagogue, specifically as a synagogue, pretty much in perpetuity. And the reason he didn't actually give it to them is they would have to pay taxes on it, and it would be very expensive. But if it's just ceded to them for their use as a synagogue, then not only do they not have to pay the property taxes, but the city, the Comune di Palermo, the municipality of Palermo, is responsible for the restructuring to bring it up to date and make sure the wiring is safe and the plumbing and all the rest of it. So actually, they don't have to pay for that. They only have to pay for what makes it a synagogue afterwards.
So you said community to be. Can you explain that a little bit? Who are these people and where are they coming from and are they really forming a community?
They're kind of disparate. They have a community but not in a formal constituted sense. They know each other. They get together. So there's Evelyn, who is the Sephardic Jewish woman from Algeria, and she's lived there for decades. There's a woman from Rome who's actually the daughter of Holocaust survivors, Miriam. There are a couple of people who know they have Jewish roots, and one or two of them actually converted formally to Judaism. One has a home in Israel and goes back and forth. Some are just curious and not really sure and interested in learning more. So it's a very disparate group. But because of this excitement around the new synagogue to be and the common interest, they come together fairly often. For example, I was at a session where they invited a woman from Rome to give a talk, a Jewish woman from Rome, to give a talk on the week's parasha, which was Midbar, with the desert. And she came, and they held it in the medieval studies center of the University of Palermo. So it's a very neutral space. It's right in the center of the old town, and anyone was welcome. It was free. And habitually, she told me, Christians come, some local Muslims come, and the message they want to give is that it's open and that they're interested in community, they're interested in people learning about each other. And so there was just this very interesting talk and discussion afterwards on, you know, desert as metaphor and what it means in the context of both Judaism and outside it. So it's a very exciting new kind of development.
When did they start to come together?
Not that long ago, some years ago, maybe, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, perhaps, as meeting on a regular basis, fairly regular basis. But of course now it'll be far more frequently because they'll have to do concrete planning about how the synagogue is physically going to be put together, you know, how it's going to be set up and decorated and where to get a Sefer Torah and whether they're going to look for a rabbi and when and so on and so forth. So they're going to have to come together on a much more regular basis.
Do you find there that the same thing is happening that happened especially in Portugal where people feel freer to come out and to go back to being Jewish than they did maybe under former regimes, let's say, that people are more interested in it and they're actually going public more?
Yeah, it's hard to say because the real equivalent of, say, the Franco regime in Spain or the Salazar in Portugal, it wasn't really the same system. But yeah, in general, they seem to be more free, as you put it, feel more free to come out. But that's just one of these three communities that I met with. So the next one is in Siracusa, which is the other side of the island of Sicily. It's maybe, I took the bus, it's a 3-hour bus trip, 2-hour car ride, I guess. And the story there is very different. There's two parts of Siracusa. There's the old part called Ortigia, and that's the old, picturesque, now very tourism-oriented, very, very pretty seaside part where the old Jewish quarter still is, the Giudecca. And then there's the northern part of the town, which is just a sort of normal, modern development with high, you know, apartment buildings and boring-looking streets, and which is more efficient but much less pretty to look at. And what happened there is, on the one hand, in Ortigia, in the pretty part, you have the Giudecca, which is about four narrow streets, and they're documented as having been the old Jewish quarter. They're very pretty, very pretty, attractive little streets. And the Mikveh. And the Mikveh was only found in 1987, so not long ago at all. And it was in the basement of a nobleman's palace. So when he discovered this, you know, in the water, actually, he called the authorities, and I'm not sure exactly how he went about it, but he notified people. And it's documented. It was a Mikveh. It's not a maybe it was, maybe it wasn't Mikveh. It was a Mikveh. There are others. There's one other that they're not sure. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but this one was. And so you can now visit it. But it's a very small, narrow, and expensive area to develop because of tourism, of course. Whereas Palermo, the old quarter, which was the old Jewish and Muslim quarter, is shabby and run down. It's beautiful, it's interesting, but at the moment it's not expensive. It's not particularly expensive to operate in. Plus they have the building. So in Siracusa, what happened is one of the men, who's now in his 80s, years and years ago, felt that he knew that he had Jewish origins, and he converted formally, I think, to Reform or Reconstructionism. And he became a rabbi. And he was also a doctor. He worked for many years in Miami, Florida. And then he retired and went back to Sicily, bought a small apartment in the new part of town, the modern part of town, and made it into a synagogue. And it's, you know, it's very, very small, but it's actually got a women's balcony in Sefer Torah. And he started holding services for anyone around who felt that they were of Jewish origin and wanted to come and learn. And Stefano Di Mauro. So when he became older and a little bit more fragile, he decided he wanted to live in Israel. So he's gone to live in Israel, and he goes for about a month or two every year, every summer. He's there now. And his best student, his most advanced student, who is a young man about 30 who's doing an anthropology degree, Gabriele Spagna, is the one who runs services and takes care of everything.
So when he started this, were there a lot of people? I mean, is Siracusa a big town? And how many takers did he have to begin with, do you know?
Well, there's not a lot in Siracusa itself. And what happens is apparently most of them who really are pretty convinced they're of Jewish origin and want to learn more about it, whether or not they convert, live an hour away in Catania. So some of them actually drive in from Catania, but they don't do that often because it's not a great road and gas is expensive and, you know, it's still 2 hours, 2.5 hours out of your day. And so they come occasionally, but they don't come every week. On a weekly basis, he only gets about 4 or 5 people. But just before I got there, when I was still in Palermo, on Shavuot, he told me they had a good 20, 25 people, of whom maybe 10 or 12 were sure that they were of Jewish origin. Some thought they might be and some weren't, but were curious. And because he's always, always had a philosophy of welcoming everyone, that's common to both these communities, anyone's welcome to go. And as long as they're respectful and as long as they're interested in learning, they're more than welcome.
Because I'm wondering if they had the same kind of problem that they've had in other places, also in Portugal. Also, I guess to some extent in Spain, only maybe there aren't that many in Spain, of, you know, if I come out and I'm interested in Judaism, or if I say I'm Jewish, what are the neighbors going to think, kind of?
That doesn't seem to be a big problem in Sicily, partly because they do have this very open attitude. The only thing I encountered, and it wasn't really that negative, was in the third place. And the third place was in Calabria, so not on the island, in the mainland. And I took the train, and the amazing thing about taking the train, which I had no idea was going to happen at all, is that when you get to the end of the island, they put the train on the boat, and they put a second train on the boat, and they're two small trains with just a few cars each. And when you get off the boat, they take both trains off the boat and couple them, and it becomes a long train and goes to Rome. But the train on the boat business takes 2 hours. So I had no idea. That's just a side comment. So there's a little tiny village. It's about 700 people in Calabria. It's called Serra Stretta. And there's been quite a lot of write-ups about this woman. Her name is Rabbi Barbara Aiello. You may have come across her name. She's been around for several years now. In fact, I first met her at a crypto-Jewish conference in San Diego, I think in 2011. She was giving a talk. So her story basically is she's from there. Her family is from this village. She was born and brought up in Pittsburgh. But she went back for just about every summer and, you know, maintained very, very close ties with the village and members of her family and neighbors. She converted to Judaism. They always had a long tradition in the family. She says that they were originally Jewish. She converted to Reform. She became a rabbi. And she's, of course, not recognized in Italy because it's only Orthodox. However, there are individual Jews in Rome and Milan, she told me, who want to be Jewish. They want to maintain a strong Jewish culture, but they don't want to be Orthodox. And so they will call her and ask her to come and officiate at a wedding or a bar mitzvah so they can actually do this without being Orthodox but without leaving Italy. And in the village itself, what was interesting is, for example, I talked to one woman, lovely woman, who said she liked her a lot. She would support her. She would always be behind her. She was friends with her. But she herself was a Catholic and didn't mind visiting the synagogue as a visit, just to be supportive, but she didn't want to go in terms of religious services. But she didn't say this in any strong negative way. It was really just a statement of who she was, and she emphasized that she liked her and she supported this, and, you know.
So there was no underlying, let's say, anti-Semitism that any of these people felt from the surrounding communities when they came out as being Jewish or interested in let's say, going back to Judaism?
Well, I have to say, this was a pilot project, so I can't say that I did deep, you know, deep, profound ethnography or anything of the depth that I've done in Portugal. And also, I speak fluent Portuguese, but I can only just barely get by in Italian. I understand what people say to me, but, you know, it's not the same as having a full conversation. I didn't get any strong anti-Semitic feeling in these contexts, but I can't promise that's a real perception. But it's what's interesting there is she also told me the same thing, that there are more people in Catania, and that she and Gabriele, the rabbinical student in Syracuse, both said they're seriously considering moving their communities to Catania because that's where they have the strongest chance of having a minyan. Mm-hmm. and actually having a functioning community. But she gets a lot of people visiting. And I think she'll have a lot more in a very short time because she's just been formally recognized by the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Council in the States. They just maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, they actually published, and I read this, not from her, I read it somewhere else recently, that they're recognizing her as a rabbi and, you know, as the head of a community. And so I think she already gets some, and I think there'll be a lot more visits. And so maybe that will spur more local people to feel confident about making some kind of at least verbal commitment. But I talked to a number of people in the village, and I didn't get any negative feeling at all. She's from there. She grew up there. I mean, she spent summers there growing up. They all know her family. They all know her husband. And the feeling I got was she was just one of the people, and that's fine. People showed me the synagogue quite proudly, actually.
You said pilot project, so where is this project going?
You always ask the good questions, Linda. I'm not sure. I would need to elaborate a more detailed project. I would need to obviously improve my Italian, and I would need to get another research grant to go back and do something more detailed. So for the moment, it's on hold, and I'm going to see what the possibilities are. But, you know, on the other hand, if I have a colleague in ethnomusicology who's, say, fluent in Italian and wants to keep going on this work, I mean, you know, like, it doesn't belong to me.
Because you didn't mention music at all.
Right. Well, my question as an ethnomusicologist is always, how do you use music and how do you use melodies and what do you choose to either maintain the identity you already have or construct the identity you're building, right? So, for example, in Portugal, they don't really have the crypto, well, ex-crypto now open. Jews in Portugal, the Judeus, don't really have melodies that are specifically theirs. They have two songs that are, but the tunes are local. The tunes are local Portuguese tunes. They're not ancient, mysterious origin tunes. And everything else they recite. They have many, many, many prayers, but the women recite them. And then everything else they sing is local music that they use in their own way, or music that they've picked up over the years that people left first vinyl recordings of Jewish music, and then cassettes, and then CDs, and now the internet, of course. And so they make choices, you know, according to their own taste, to their ideas. For example, in Lisbon, some of them told me they used Shlomo Carlebach tunes because they liked them and added a bit of fado spice. And another one told me they used Ashkenazi tunes because the Masorti conservative Ashkenazi rabbis were more open to them than the Sephardic Orthodox ones, and out of sympathy. So, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. So in Italy, what I could gather is they're very confused and they don't know what music to use. So when I asked them, they actually asked me and said, you know, can you give us some ancient medieval Sephardic melodies? And so I had to trot out a shortened version of, you know, my lecture C1. There are no ancient medieval Sephardic melodies that have survived, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, look, I can teach you any tunes you like. That's not a problem. But what Jews have always done is we've always adapted as well music from our surroundings and used it. And you in Sicily have some of the most beautiful folk tunes I've heard anywhere. And they're accessible tunes. They're tunes you can hum. They're tunes you can sing. And, you know, you have people here who know Hebrew, and like Evelyn and Angelo, and who can help you adapt these tunes to Hebrew texts, make sure the poetry works, the scansion works, the accents work, or I can help you, or I can direct you to people who can. So this, like, an incipient project for them. And we'll see where it takes them, where they go. Rabbi Barbara, told me she has a couple of local melodies she uses. She thinks, because of an article she read, but it's incorrect, the article, that the famous Italian tune, Bella Ciao, the partisan song, you know, Questa mattina io sono alzato, Bella Ciao, Bella Ciao. There's an article that says it's an old ancient Yiddish song. And it's based on the fact that only the first phrase, da-da-da-da, only that, is similar to a Yiddish vaudeville tune from the States from the 1920s, which, of course, does not make this ancient Yiddish. But it's not even, it's just like that one tiny little phrase. And from this, an Italian musician worked up this fantasy and published it. So she uses that tune. But it's a beautiful tune. You want to use that tune? Great, terrific, you know. So it remains to be seen where they take that.
So you haven't run into anybody who said, well, my grandmother sang me this lullaby.
No, always my great hopes, you know. But that usually turns out like the story that circulated here for a while with someone who's now passed away, and I won't speak ill of them, but the story itself was she misunderstood entirely what a young Ibiza man said about his grandmother singing medieval Ladino lullabies. First of all, we don't have any medieval Ladino lullabies. We don't even have medieval Ladino altogether, or medieval lullabies in music. But all he had done was play for his grandmother a cassette at the time of the Spanish folk group Raíces singing Sephardic songs in a very Castilian folk style. And one of the songs they sang was the old ballad of the husband's return, you know, where he comes back after 7 years and she doesn't recognize him and he tests her. He says, oh, your husband's died. And his last words were that you should marry me. And she says, no, 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 I'll be faithful to him all my life. And he says, okay, it's me. So that's a pan-European ballad, actually. It's sung in just about every culture of Europe and even outside. And, of course, there's a Spanish version, many Spanish versions. There are Sephardic versions from Morocco, from Turkey. So all she said, and he gave me the cassette where she says this, and you hear him saying, grandmother, grandmother, do you recognize this old song? And she keeps saying, no, no, I don't recognize it. And finally, the words to this, she said, well, the words, the story is familiar. And from that, she sang him ancient medieval Sephardic lullabies. So you have to be very careful about people saying things like that. You know, you have to also keep asking questions and see where these statements are coming from.
We're kind of running out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just this is a very exciting new project for me, and I hope to be able to continue it. And this is the first time I've talked about it except to friends over coffee, and it's probably the first time I've tried to put it in any kind of logical order, which is actually always easier with you because you ask good questions.
Well, when it's further along or when it's finished, I hope that we can talk about it again.
I hope so. Good to see you.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.